This is KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale, KSQD 89.5, 89.7, 90.7 FM, or online at ksqd.org. From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. Anthony Horowitz returns to the show this week. He is England's best living crime writer, and he's written approximately 42,000 novels and television shows, including my favorite, Foyle's War. If you haven't watched that, start tonight. His latest novel is the sixth in his Hawthorne and Horowitz series, which features a detective of enormous skill, Daniel Hawthorne, and his rather bumbling chronicler, a man called Anthony Horowitz. The book is called A Deadly Episode. Anthony Horowitz, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
Loved the book. If I was going to write a series of novels with myself as a character, you know, I think I would make myself handsome and brilliant.
Well, let me say straight away that you called it the Hawthorne Horowitz series. I call it the Hawthorne series because I didn't think of myself as a major character in it. I'm the narrator. Yes. I'm Watson to his Holmes, and I'm on the side of it. And really, the spotlight is on him. And the idea of making myself some kind of buffed up hero of this book never entered my mind.
But the books are they're set in a real world in which you live, in which you are the creator of Foyle's War and Midsummer Murders and all the things that you do.
Well, the Anthony in the books is most certainly me, and most of what I write is true. I mean, the things you read about the jobs I'm doing, in the fourth book it was a play of mine that was put on in the West End, and the fifth book was set in Richmond, which is where I now live. So it is chronicling my life in a way, but nonetheless, when I pitched this idea to my publishers way back, you know, 6-7 years ago, they were quite nervous. You know, is this going to be an ego trip? Are you going to be sort of banging your own drum and going on about how great your books are? And I said, no, not a bit of it. I am not the main character in this. I'm going to be on the side. And the idea that I should be clever or should be sort of, you know, stealing the limelight from Hawthorne is the exact opposite of what I wanted to do.
These books are crime stories, and the crimes are interesting and great as crime stories go. But they're also comedies, wouldn't you say?
The books are becoming more comedic as they go on. But then I wouldn't call them comedies because I've never particularly liked the genre of comedy crime capers, if you like. I think crime is too serious to take too lightly. I think murder, it's one of the things I've been investigating in my writing for a long time now, which is, why is murder, which is beastly and evil, and if you saw it in the street, you would be horrified, how is it that that becomes entertainment when it's transferred into books and that we enjoy them? So I've always treated the murders and the characters who commit murder with a degree of seriousness. But that said, I don't think you can have a 350-page book which is just all about sort of blood and death and whatever. And and the comic touches are sort of, there are chapters that appear, particularly in A Deadly Episode. There's one chapter in particular, which is fairly raucous, I think is necessary. It's a sort of a contrast to the sort of darker side of the books.
Well, I'm a big fan of Anthony Horowitz's books, and some of the things that you've written in addition to your own things is you did three great James Bond novels, and you did a couple Sherlock Holmes novels, and I can see, and I think you were probably writing some of those when you started this series, and I can see that there's a sort of obviously you have the Sherlock Holmes Watson dynamic going, but also there's a bit of the Ian Fleming dynamic in that each of the books leads into the next book in the way that the Ian Fleming series of James Bond books do.
It's a good observation, and it's absolutely true. You know, just as you can read, incidentally, the James Bond books individually, you don't need to read them in any particular order. That is largely true of my books. They are all standalone murder mysteries, although there is an arc, that arc mainly being my investigation into the character of Hawthorne. This is a man who is difficult. He's prickly. We have quite a occasionally strained relationship. But as the books go on, I become more and more aware that he is a product of his life, that something happened to him when he was young in a place called Reith in Yorkshire, which is where he was born, and I'm trying to find out what that event was, like any writer would. I mean, a writer is always investigating his or her characters. I'm just doing it for real inside these stories.
So did you write, before you began writing this series, did you write a biography of Hawthorne? Do you know, do you, the writer, not the character that you play in the books, but do you know everything about?
I did not do that, no. The reason I didn't do it was twofold. First of all, I always think that if I know too much, if I don't surprise myself in the books, how can I surprise my readers? I want them to share the journey with me. So I wanted to have a journey to go on. And the second reason was that I had a suspicion that whatever it was that had happened to Hawthorne, it was something quite dark and quite bad. And I didn't want to get to it too quickly. I wanted to get to it book by book and let it sort of reveal itself as I was going. I had a broad idea of what it was going to be about. And even now, I'm quite nervous of reaching the last book in the series because it's not necessarily a story I particularly want to tell. But I will get there, and I'll get there fairly soon, I think.
You have how many books do you think there'll be left here in this series?
When I started, I thought this was going to be a 12-book series. I'm thinking now probably 9 or 10. Six is a deadly episode. I'm about halfway through book number 7, which I've started writing with a sort of a burst of passion. I was so excited about it, but I wanted to get started on it, and I'm about halfway through now. Not that I'll tell my publishers, because The one thing I never, ever do is deliver early. They sort of pounce on me and it speeds things up too much. Then I'm going to take a break from murder mystery altogether. I'm going to do a sort of a historical thriller. And after that, I think I'll probably do 2 more. That'll make, if my maths is correct, 10.
And while you've been writing these 6 books, you've been writing other books. How do you do you have a clone, or how does it work? Well, of course, there's a clone of you in the books, but I mean, is there more than one? Do you have a team of people?
No, not at all. I mean, writing is my life. I love everything about writing. I love paper. I love ink. I love fountain pens. I love thinking up ideas and writing the ideas and the whole business, the panoply of being published and going on the road and meeting people like you and having conversations like this. It makes me very happy that in a somewhat difficult and conflicted world, I've managed to pursue a career that has done no harm, but I have just entertained people for getting on for 50 years now with my writing. And that seems to me to be an enormous stroke of luck, if nothing else.
All right. Well, I want to ask you a question, and I'm not sure how to ask it clearly. So in each of these books, in A Deadly Episode, for instance, you are writing a book called A Deadly Episode. Is the book that I am reading a book? Is it the book that you're writing in the book, or is it a book about you writing the book that's the book in the book?
That is, without any question, the most complicated question I've ever been asked, and I'm not even sure I can make complete sense of it. I'm not good on timelines. I'm not sure at what point in my real life, outside the books, I began writing the Hawthorne novels. And if you try and piece it together, like, for example, book number 1 has me working on the Tintin film with Steven Spielberg and Peter Jackson. And I can't now remember when that was or when it is in the book. And I do get into difficulties with timelines. But I think that, generally speaking, that the books are written by an Anthony slightly ahead of me now. The new book I'm writing is set in 2021. We're in 2026. And I would guess that I'm not making any sense, because two of the books have already been published. So, you know, that is to say, the word is murder and the sentence is death is referenced inside. So it becomes confusing. But I think when it is a future Anthony writing about a relationship that has gone back, shall we say, if it's a book a year, 7 or 8 years so far, and then finishes.
So if I were to live in the world in which these stories take place, and I picked up one of the books, would I be reading the same book that I read here in this world?
Yes, I think you would, because the books are pretending to be the truth. I mean, and although I fiddle around, I'll give you a good example. In the fourth book, Twist of a Knife, a play of mine is being put on the stage. And the play gets a diabolical review from a critic, Harriet Throsby, who is then murdered, and all the evidence suggests that the killer was me.
Right.
And that's a fun story. And the play that she has given this bad review to is called Mind Game. And Mind Game was a play that I wrote. But when I wrote the book, I actually swapped a play, because in fact I had also written a play called Dinner with Saddam. And that one was very, very harshly treated by the critics. In fact, it's one of my sadnesses in life, and I haven't yet managed to crack theatre. I will. I'm not giving up. But I changed the plays. In other words, I put an earlier play in into the future. So that was, as it were, playing like a sort of a jigsaw puzzle with my life and moving a piece across the board or something about it. That's not a very good analogy, but you know what I mean. Everything is a mess. It's all muddled. But, you know, my favourite writer, Conan Doyle, my favourite mystery writer, Conan Doyle, also played games with time and with, you know, and got it all wrong, and his timelines don't quite work, and there are so many sort of things in his books that don't quite add up. But to me, what matters much, much more than these questions, which are sort of complicated, is the sort of the mystery itself, the murder story, the fun of the pursuit, the reveal of the killer, all that stuff. Trying to work out the sort of the metafictional reality of it, I think will put readers off. And it's something I urge them not to do. Just go with the flow.
All right. I'll
don't ask too many questions.
I'll stop thinking about
it. I thought a good thing to say to you.
Well, you know, I don't have time usually for recorded books. I love them, but I'm always in a hurry to read the books that I'm reading because I'm going to be talking to the author, you know, next Tuesday. So I don't get much opportunity to hear recorded books, but your books in this series have all been recorded by Roy Kinnear. So I had to take a minute and listen to some. And I love him, and he does a wonderful version of you. What a fine actor he is. He does your voice. I mean, I know your voice well because you and I have talked quite a few times, and it really sounds like you. I think he's great. He does a marvelous job with those books.
Well, Rory, I'm so glad you said this, Gary, because Rory Kinnear, I am so lucky to have him. He's done all the books so far, including number six, the one we're discussing. And he is a brilliant actor. I mean, he is a first-rate actor. And he does. I am absolutely in awe when I listen to the books. I can't listen to them cover to cover, actually, because I just find it too weird in a strange way. But I'm listening to myself, but it sort of isn't me. But he is just brilliant. And he's also lovely and, you know, very easy to get on with. I wrote for his late father, who was also a very famous actor. He appeared in a film I wrote. His last performance, actually, of Rory's father, Roy Kinnear, was in a film I'd written. So I have a connection with him that goes back a long way.
I loved him. Of course, he's in the Beatles movie Help. He plays Algernon.
Absolutely right. I mean, with Victor Spinetti.
Yeah, and he makes me laugh, and he's hilarious in that movie, and he's great in all of his films. I was a big fan of his. So the first time...
I was very lucky to meet him.
Oh, neat. What was the film that you wrote?
It's a film. You won't find it now. It's an extraordinary thing that most of my work is still available one way or another. Yeah. And it's either on DVD or it's still in print. But I think the film, which is called In This Country, Just Ask for Diamonds, not a good title. It's based on a book called The Falcon's Malteser, which is, I think, a very good title. But curiously, the company that makes Maltesers, which is a little chocolate, refused to let us use the title.
I don't know why they would do that.
So the title changed. But he played Roy Kinnear. Was it Roy Kinnear or Ray Kinnear? I can't remember what the father was called now. Roy, it was Roy.
Yeah.
He was the owner of the Splendide Hotel in London, and the character he played was Jack Splendide.
How great. Yeah, no, he was hilarious. He's great in a lot of films, not just Help, but I mean, that's the one that
he was in The Three Musketeers, I think, as well.
Yes, he's in some of other Richard Lester films, the one that's a bomb on a boat. He's in that one too.
Well, the great British movies of the 60s and 70s, yeah.
Yeah, so great. And you can see Rory in lots of things, including I can't remember the title of it, but the television series that's on now, The Diplomat. He's in that, and he's quite good.
Yes,
and he's in the James Bond movies. So
he did turn into I've actually worked with quite a few James Bond actors one way or another, because of course Michael Kitchen was in those films too. I think at the same time as Rory.
Your James Bond connection continues. Let me ask you what about Hawthorne. He's a remarkable detective, and your relationship with him is really interesting. I wonder if, you know, is he anything like Foyle, or how would they? What if you swapped them? What if it was Hawthorne's war? Who's a better detective? I think Foyle wouldn't.
Oh, you are putting me on the spot today.
I don't think Foyle would stand for you as a chronicler the way you.
They're very different. They belong to completely different worlds. I mean, that's one of the interesting things about what you're asking, which is that Foyle belongs so much to the sort of 1940 to 47 world in which he finds himself. And the key to his character is that he's a detective at a time when crime doesn't matter, when crime is insignificant, because if you've got 500 people being killed every single day just the other side of the channel, why should you give a damn about the lady with a knife in her back in the library, sort of that Agatha Christie sort of trope? And Foyle spends the entire series wanting to fight and to be in the war. Hawthorne, I guess, lives in a slightly more real, he certainly lives in a more modern world, but he lives in the world of policing and such, and is, crime defines him. So I see no similarities really between them at all. And Foyle, I think, is a much warmer character of the two. When I was writing those TV shows, the music and the credits had three spotlights behind it, three searchlights going like that. And I always thought that those three searchlights were Foyle, Milner, and Sam Stewart, the three main characters who were the light in the darkness. I have a feeling that Hawthorne is a little bit the darkness in the light.
Ah, interesting. And he's difficult, but at the same time, he imposes himself in your life in a way that everybody loves him.
one of my favorite moments in the new book is when they're casting the film for The Word Is Murder, which is where the action is set. And I point out that every actor in town wants to play Hawthorne. Daniel Day-Lewis even announces he'll come out of retirement if he can play that part. But nobody in the whole country or in the world wants to play the sidekick. And that so defines our relationship. But, you know, the thing about it is, and it's very important, this, that it is impossible, I think, to write a detective series if we do not like the detective. If you look, going back to Sherlock Holmes, that character, he's cold, he's aloof, he's a drug addict, he's got no particular interests outside crime fighting, and sort of, you know, forensic science. He's untidy, he's often quite cold-blooded, but Watson loves him, and that's why we love him. It is the greatest friendship in British literature. And I realized very quickly when I was writing The Word Is Murder that if I had this character who had so many flaws, views with which I didn't agree, and a certain prickliness and a sort of an unpleasantness even, then people would not enjoy the books. And therefore, the Anthony in the books, with every book that has been written, has become warmer towards him and closer to him and more admiring of him. And I hope that works in the same way.
He makes models. He likes to make models of planes and war objects. And I wonder, where did you get that? Do you like to do that? Did you make models?
No, it's not a passion of mine. It was my brother who used to do that when we were young. And I still remember that when I was given model kits, which as a kid I often was, Airfix was the big manufacturer of these Second World War, largely planes and tanks and everything. I can still remember having these wretched pieces glued to my fingers, refusing to come off. And that somehow the model was never, ever made, and it always ended up in the dustbin. And it always went, you know, the finished thing was this lump of plastic with wings in the wrong direction and glue all over them, like spiders' webs of glue everywhere, completely useless for warfare or for a child's toy, into the bin with them. And maybe that was that memory that was coming through when I made it for him. Although I will say that in the next book I'm writing, there is a moment with a toy soldier, which is, I can't wait to write it because it is so chilling. Oh, and tells you so much about him.
I'm looking forward to that. Well, I had that same experience with model kits, but the glue got me so stoned that I didn't care by the time we threw the thing.
Oh, well, there you go then. You weren't meant to sniff it, Harry. You were meant to squeeze it. Oh. But still. And the paint, those paints always ran. They always ran the paint. I don't know why.
It's very difficult. Yeah, well, I admire his skill, and I can picture them in my mind.
But you see, it also fits his character very well, because he does have a slightly sort of ADHD sort of side to him. There is a little bit of that in him, and that in many detectives have that same sort of, you know, that's what he's doing for her life. He is taking clues and he's piecing them together. I've never said that before. I suddenly think that's quite a good observation, but actually that is what he does in his life. He takes the different pieces of a crime and he puts them together into a finished model
and focuses.
I should use that sometime.
Yeah, you should. He's focused so intensely on them that he doesn't notice that his house is
I think that's the other side to him as well. But because he is a loner, because he doesn't really have a family, doesn't have friends, he doesn't have anything very much, this allows him, like books did for me when I was young, I hid in books. And although Hawthorne is also part of a book club and has an interest in fiction, and we learn in the new book an interest in films, or maybe I think I put that into book number 6, yes. That he lives just up the road from the biggest movie, sort of classic movie theatre in London, and he has a knowledge of film. And incidentally, writing things like that about him, I love doing. When I started this series, it didn't occur to me that he might be a film buff. But then you think about it, you meet people and you know them for a time, and then they suddenly surprise you by saying, you know, I love classical music or something that you did, or chess or something that you didn't realize. And it gives another dimension to their character. And I think it's great, therefore, to have a character who can be a little bit sort of chameleon-like and can change as the stories go on.
I was watching Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho again the other day. And in Psycho, you begin to care about Anthony Perkins's character, even though he is the title character of the movie. I don't have to worry about spoilers about movies that came out in 1960, do I?
If anybody is listening to this who doesn't know Psycho and hasn't seen it, I would be surprised.
All right, so, but your allegiance in the movie changes from Janet Leigh's character to Anthony Perkins' character almost the moment that she dies. And there are a lot of murderers that become sympathetic characters television series, Dexter, for instance. And you were just talking about having the affection for, and I have an enormous affection for Foyle and all of his compatriots in their crime fighting in Hastings. Have you ever considered having the bad guy be sympathetic in your story?
You know, Gary, in my view, they all are. In every single book I have written, there has been a modicum of sympathy for the killers. Because I always think that, and again, this goes back to the discussion about what is murder and why are we interested in it. People largely, certainly not in mystery novels, they don't commit murder for fun. They don't do it because it's just a thing they want to do. There are people like that in the world, and I don't want to write about them, and I suspect, you know, unless you make it someone like Hannibal Lecter, who was a brilliant creation, you know, by Thomas Harris, somebody who revels in murder and savagery, and is also witty with it and somehow likable. That's the miracle of those books. But in my books, I always think to myself, but somebody who has done this terrible thing always has a sort of a something that you can empathize with, a reason for it. You know, they haven't done it just for pleasure. You know, one of my favorite Agatha Christie motive is in a book called The Mirror Crack from Side to Side, where the killer, when you get to the end, it's so understandable. You think, gosh, I might have done that. And that's another aspect about it. We are all capable of committing murder given the right circumstances, the right chain of events. And if one of us falls and does commit murder, I think there is always a modicum of sympathy. And the third book, A Line to Kill, the killer in that book, I completely get why they do it. And the killer, I think, is much more sympathetic than the person who is killed. So I think throughout my books, that's always been the case. I don't think I will ever write a book in which murder is condoned, however. You know, sometimes in Foyle's War, there were at least two episodes where the killers said to him, look, what good is it going to do putting me behind bars? I did what I did, but I'm needed for the war effort, or I did what I did, but you'd have done the same. And each time, I think, Foyle has made the correct moral choice. Well, you have to.
In Foyle's War, there is a character who commits a murder and in fact, does walk away from it because of his position.
But that's not the same as being forgiven by Foyle. And in fact, Foyle does later on.
He goes and tracks him down.
We refer to it back again. He goes after that person. But there is a character in one of the later episodes that I wrote, and it's a woman who has... She hasn't killed anybody, but she has stolen a diamond and the diamond was originally from a Jewish family, I think. The family were exterminated by the Nazis. She's got the diamond, and she has stolen it. But she needs dialysis. This is in the very, very early days. She is going to die unless she can find the money to pay for her operation. And she says to Foyle, are you going to take those diamonds back and kill me? And that, I think, is a really interesting moral question. What would you do? And in that episode, I will tell you, I didn't reveal what he did. Sam or somebody asks him, what did you do? And he refuses to answer and just drives away. That's the end of the show. One of my favorite episodes.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah, last time we talked, you said that you might be in the mood to go back and watch all of the Foyle's War in a row. I offered to lend you my DVD box set. But you said
I have started. Yeah. I have started. They're on Apple. They're on not Apple. They're on Amazon. Suddenly they've come up on Amazon, so I can see them when I want to. And I did watch two or three, but I think I need to go away to do it. It interferes with my work. I don't like going backwards. I'm always looking forwards to the next book, to the next. You know, I don't reread my books unless I have to. For example, when I was writing Marble Hall Murders, I reread something of Magpie Murders to remind myself of what Susan Ryland had been up to. The same is true of when I wrote Alex Rider. I'd always have to go back and look at what I'd done before. But to look at my own work for sort of pleasure, for satisfaction, doesn't quite work for me. I'm too critical of myself, first of all, but secondly, I'm more forward-looking. And what I will do, so you can remind me of this the next time we talk, is one day I might go away somewhere on holiday and leave all my work behind. And then I might watch the whole of Foyle. But I watched three or four episodes.
Yeah, they're so good. I really love them. And when I was telling somebody yesterday that I was going to be talking to you, they said, oh, Foyle's War, it's the greatest. Tell them
Foyle's War, which is, you know, I don't think it's ever been off the screen. It's always available somewhere. And it's wonderful to have written it. That and Alex Rider, you know, I'm proud of both of them equally because they have had such staying power and have been such a sort of a huge part of my life. And I'm proud of the fact, you know, I don't want to sound boastful, but I am proud of the fact that I have managed to create two such sort of, such big figures and, you know, such long-lasting figures. You know, that it's you think about how quickly books come and go from bookshelves or from TV screens And it's one of the scary things about modern life is the short life of most books. And I'm thrilled that I've managed to sort of buck that trend and that you can still get most of my books, not all of them, but most of them are still available.
When you reference earlier adventures in A Deadly Episode or in any of the six books in this series, are you careful not to reveal the the secret of each of those books, even though, of course, all the characters know those secrets because they'd already happened.
Only in one book, Marble Hall Murders, do I reveal who the killer was in one of the earlier books. And there is a warning on page one. Do not read this book if you haven't read Magpie Murders, and if you're planning to, because it does give away the solution. It was necessary because it was actually, for me, it was a really interesting book to write, Marble Hall, because it revisited the killer from the first book. And that's something that very, very rarely happens in crime fiction, where the killer in an earlier book turns up to... I mean, funnily enough, Thomas Harris did do it in his Red Dragon, the character from that turns up, I think, more than once. But I enjoyed doing that. But generally speaking, in the Hawthorne books, I don't give away the secret to the earlier books because I'd love people like you to read all of them.
All right. I did. It was lovely to read them all in a row. I really enjoyed it. In the chronicle of your life part of those books, occasionally people will come to you and they're adults who read Alex Rider when they were young. And I'm sure that happens to you in real life all the time.
Happened to me yesterday. I mean, it happens all the time. Yeah. I mean, it's often when I'm in a TV studio, the guy behind the camera or somebody, the studio manager will say, you know, I used to read your books. And I like to think of it makes me very happy to think that I have been, as it were, one molecule in their bloodstream. I'm not saying I've been a huge influence, but they have read Alex Rider when they were 13 or 14, and that little molecule of my world and my ideas has stayed in their bloodstream and maybe has been of help to them. I don't know, especially if they're entering into the world of sort of creativity in some way, because, of course, reading is a wonderful way to become creative yourself, to train your mind into thinking imaginatively. That's what reading does for you. So that's why when I said earlier that I was proud to have created both Fool's War and Alex Rider in particular, for helping to get so many young children to read.
Yeah, reading makes you smarter, people. Anthony Horowitz is my guest, and he's just written another in his Hawthorne series, which I call Hawthorne and Horowitz series, and it's called A Deadly Episode. So because Anthony Horowitz is a character in these books, I want to ask about his origin story. How did you come to writing as a writing scripts first or writing books first? And were you writing children's books? Was that the first thing you did?
Yes, I started when I was 10. That's when I wrote my first long piece of fiction.
10? You were 10.
Yeah, 10. I remember it. I was at a very unpleasant school. I was a boarder. That meant I was there day and night. Mm. It was an extremely dangerous and unpleasant environment. Every form of abuse you can imagine was prevalent. I hated it with every fiber of my being. And I was also being taught over and over again that I was stupid and useless and would never amount to anything. And then I found the library, which was my safe place. And books and reading, not great books, not serious books. My first love was Tintin, although I think Tintin, incidentally, the Hergé was a genius and the books are masterpieces. But nonetheless, I read them as sort of comic stories. Tintin is a writer, a journalist, and I wanted to be like him. And from being in the library, I started telling stories to the other children in the dormitories where we slept, six beds, six kids to a room. And two things happened as a result of this. The first was that I discovered I wasn't as stupid as the teacher said. I had an ability. I could do it. I did it fluently, quickly, and found myself. And secondly, I made friends because the other children liked the stories. And so I didn't continue to be the sort of chubby little loser, to quote Ricky Gervais, that I was at that time. And I knew, age 10, that I'd be a writer. There was never, you know, I still remember in those dormitories when I was about 11 and 12, practicing my signature for the time when I would need to sign books and that sort of thing. And then through my teens, I was writing the whole time and such. I was published for the first time when I was 21 or 22. That was a children's book.
When I was 10, I was thinking maybe someday in the future, I'll learn to read. But and here you had written an entire book already.
Well, why didn't you, you must be able to read at age 10.
I wasn't very good at it. But comic books helped me a lot, actually. I think I really became a reader at about age 11.
Oh, well, that's early. And I became a proper reader later, you know, really seriously reading masses in my 20s. Mm. Until then, I read Agatha Christie in my teens. I read James Bond, I loved. And I read a lot of sort of quite pulpy books. And then I'll never forget it. I was on holiday in Istanbul. I was with a friend of mine, a school friend. His father was the one under the ambassador, he was a consul. Mm. And he saw me reading a bad book. He said, "Why are you reading that? Sort of, you know, rubbish paperback. Read this." And he gave me Great Expectations by Charles Dickens. And that moment was another life-changing moment, because I reluctantly started to read it and then realized I was loving it. And since then, Dickens has been my great hero.
It's one of the secrets, isn't it? I remember when I read it, I was in my 20s, I think. But I thought, well, I would never read Dickens. It looks, for one thing, it's so imposingly big. You know, it's a great book. And then you start reading it and you go, oh, it's fantastic. It's funny and adventuresome and great.
You know, his books, the relationship between him, I mean, obviously he's a 10 times better writer than me, but the inspiration I've taken from it is what you've just said, because we were talking earlier about whether comedy has a place in crime fiction. And I'm saying I didn't like funny crime fiction, but yes, comedy does have a place. And that's something I've learned from Dickens. You can go from scenes of depravity and you know, poverty and suffering to scenes with a comical character, you know, running around the room being funny. And for that matter, actually many of the great writers have learned that books are fluid, that you can have different moods and different sections. You don't need to be sort of grim and dour or frightening and whatever for the whole book. But that's something I certainly learned from him.
Why were you in boarding school when you were little?
I wish I could answer that question. My parents died when I was quite young, so I was never able to have the conversation with them about why, when they could see quite clearly that I was having a horrible time and was hysterically unhappy at this place and brutalized there, you know, beaten so regularly and often. Why did they do it? The only answer I can give is that my parents were middle-class Jews living in North London, and they wanted me to be very English. They wanted me to be, you know, they wanted me to grow up and be an establishment kid in the British establishment, and that therefore this sort of education would be good for me. But, you know, beatings and cold showers and sort of general brutality would just make me stronger. The opposite was true. But that, I suspect, is why they did it. Well, why would you pay large amounts of money to have your child brutalized? It makes no sense.
Yeah, you could brutalize them at home.
Well,
think of all the money you'd save. Foyle's War is set in the Second World War, a time when, you know, anti-Semitism fomented a war. And I wonder how, as a Jewish person, as a writer, how do you feel about anti-Semitism in the world today? Are you concerned?
Of course I'm concerned. You can't be Jewish and not be concerned. In this country, it's become ever more prevalent, anti-Semitism. And since there was only yesterday, a synagogue in Finchley was attacked. And you may have heard about ambulances being set on fire for a Jewish ambulance service. And what was so distressing about it was, although it was run by Jews, this service, it helped the entire community. What sort of person sets ambulances on fire? But obviously Israel's decision since the 7th of October and the have changed the world picture and the way people see Israel and by extension Jews. And I have to be honest and say that in my country, I can't speak for America, but in my country, I don't think the government has handled it at all well. There have been demonstrations in the street which have been threatening and possibly illegal, in the sense not about censorship, but merely because supporting a terrorist organization in this country is illegal. But they have been allowed to happen, and Jews have felt unsafe in the streets. And with every incident that takes place we get the same message. This is awful. This is unbearable. We won't allow this to happen. We stand by the Jewish community. We will do nothing. And it continues. And I do think we are slipping into a very dangerous place. I don't want to talk politics particularly, but I will just say this, that every Jew I know has a very mixed feelings about what is happening in Gaza, in Israel, in the Middle East. And every person that I know, every Jew that I know, wants there to be peace and happiness and prosperity for everybody in that region. Nobody supports entirely what is happening. But if we move to a position where you can no longer say that you believe in the state of Israel without being victimized, I think something terrible has happened and something terrible has changed.
I saw Bruce Springsteen in concert the other night, and his concert tour is largely driven by his political beliefs. And he said he didn't intend to do this tour, but politics has kind of forced him to do it. And I wonder, as a writer, I understand what you're saying about not wanting to talk about politics in particular, but when you look at the world situation, and you are a writer that has the eyes and ears of so many devoted readers, do you feel any compulsion to make any kind of statement that your followers would read?
It's a very difficult question to answer. I have to ask myself, first of all, why should I know any more than anybody else in the street? Just because I write crime fiction and have done well out of it and I'm successful at it and have sold lots of books, does that make me an expert on world affairs? I don't think so. And I think it's a huge mistake for anybody, whether it's a famous actor or a famous writer or a famous whatever it might be, to suddenly stand on a soapbox and start, shouting views out, because why should they know anything more than anybody else? What makes it different is, of course, that I am Jewish and therefore should be defending my family, my safety, my beliefs and everything else. But at the end of the day, my first loyalty is to my books, to the publishers who pay me to write them, to the bookstores that sell them. And standing up and making political statements will not help that. I don't see, I'm not talking about here, I'm scared of losing sales or scared of losing money or anything like that. I just am devoted to writing, not to world politics. So the answer to your question is that by and large, I do not. I've said more to you, in fact, than I perhaps should have. And now I'm wondering and worrying that I have said something that will get me into some sort of fix. But I think to talk about anti-Semitism as a great worry and as a new, and not obviously it's the oldest evil in the world, but it's new manifestation, is reasonable enough given what is happening. But talking about what should be done in the Middle East, and if you ask me about the American incursion into Iran, I have thoughts about that, but I don't think I'll share them with you.
I understand. I understand completely. So in your newest book, and we're talking with the brilliant Anthony Horowitz in his new book, in his Hawthorne series, it's called The Deadly Episode. In the book, they're making a television play of, or is it a film? I can't remember which it is. I'm sorry.
It's actually a feature film. It should be called A Deadly Episode. It should be a TV series. But actually, that wasn't my original title, and it is a feature film.
But will there be films of this character?
There will hopefully be a TV series, because while I was writing the book, if you want to get into meta complications, try and work this one out. Okay. While I was writing a book about a fictional Anthony being involved in a fictional film based on his first book, I was also in real life writing the screenplay of The Word is Murder, the first book, for Jill Green, to be filmed hopefully next year. Now, whether it will happen or not, I don't know. The script is finished and I'm very happy with it. Jill is brilliant at both selling and at producing and, you know, getting things done. But these are very, very difficult times in television. I mean, it's one of the paradoxes of the time I live in, that we are in the golden age of television. I've been watching The Pitt recently, and wow, that is an incredible piece of TV. I also am a huge fan of Vince Gilligan, and Pluribus blew me away that anybody could write anything so extraordinary and so different. And there are many, many shows that I admire. But the trouble is that what's happened is that it's the big shows and coming out of the big platforms, you know, the Apples and the Amazons and all the rest of them, that are taking over the world. And for somebody like me, selling a sort of a rather smaller show about a writer and a detective solving crimes in England, it's much, much harder now to find the finance for it. But as I say, Jill is onto it, and she's never failed yet.
Well, will Rory Kinnear play you in the show?
That's a good question. We're nowhere near even asking it. You know, we've managed to get finance for the script we've written, and so we're a little way down the line. Now we need to get, you know, finance for production and a director, and I suspect it'll be the director who makes decisions on casting. I'll tell you one person who will not play me.
Yes.
Who will not play me, and that's me. I mean, some people are asking, would I play myself? That would be a recipe for total disaster.
Did you ever do any acting in your life?
I did act when I was at school. And when I left school, my great dream was to work in theatre. I loved theatre. My first job in London was working as an usher of a national theatre. I spent 2 years selling ice creams and helping people to their seats and doing all the rest of it. I was wildly happy.
And you have done theater because you've written plays.
I've done written 2 plays with mixed results. You know, I always make a joke, which is that the critics were divided 50-50 about my plays. Half of them hated them and half of them loathed them.
Well, I'm sure you're exaggerating, but the thing is, I'm a big fan of yours, but there's so much of your work that I haven't read, and it's not because I don't want to. It's because you've written just way too many things. You've written more things than one person should have written.
I think that's true. And I do worry sometimes that I have written too much. And I look at my life and I think to myself, have I missed out? There was a writer who was I think it was Ian Rankin, actually, who was talking in the papers a couple of weeks ago, saying that he should have spent more time with his family and been closer to his kids and all the rest of it, which incidentally I think is nonsense, because I've met him with his family and he is a wonderful father and husband. I do sometimes think that maybe I have written too much, but at the same time, I love writing. I've already said it. I don't, as it were, you know, mass produce these books. They're not just being poured onto the page. Oh, you know, I need to do this, do another book. I get ideas. The ideas are irresistible. They make me smile. And I can't stop myself. I am utterly addicted to writing.
Well, there are, you know, authors who've written 5 books, and there are authors who've written 87 books. I mean, and that doesn't have any reflection on the quality of the books, because somebody could write 5 terrible books or somebody could write 87 Agatha Christie novels. When you're writing, do you pore over every line? Are you a very slow?
Yeah. Yes, every word, every line, every word. As I've got older, I've sometimes found the word I want to be just around the corner out of my mind. So I have a thesaurus that I go to. I love reading a thesaurus. I love words. So to find sort of 15 or 20 words that sort of mean approximately the same, but then to find the one which I had in mind all the time is always a bit of a joy in itself. And I, you know, I try to write well. The writers I most love, 19th century novelists, we've mentioned Dickens. We could all talk about Hardy and Austen and George Gissing, George Orwell a bit later. You know, and Doyle, great Gothic romanticist, brilliant writer. You know, a writer of atmosphere and of weather, of mood. I admire these writers, and I try to make my writing as good as it can be. And yes, there's not a single word in my book, not one, but I won't have pondering on some for longer than others.
Well, and you also have written films and television things based on your work. And I know you're a fan of Ian Fleming because you've written 3 James Bond novels in his style. I mean, they're definitely your books, but they are. And I think Trigger Mortis is just hilarious, the way you kind of tweaked his world in such a wonderful way. But, you know, Ian Fleming's books are so different than the movies. They've never made a single movie that's actually based on an Ian Fleming novel. And
it's not quite true. From Russia with Love was very close. Dr. No was as well. The third one in that line, what was it? I think Goldfinger starts to move away, although even Goldfinger is sort of... Goldfinger is not... In the book, it's just stealing gold, and in the film, it's about blowing the gold up so it becomes radioactive and useless. Great idea, incidentally. But then as the films move on, they get ever wider and further away from the original books.
There's very little similarity between, you know, Roger Moore on skis and James Bond in it.
Well, Roger Moore, I mean, you know, I've liked all the Bonds, and I think that the way that the Bond films have reinvented themselves has been really clever, because if they had just stuck doing the books, they might not have had this. So, you know, the fact that they can somehow chime with every period they come out in is really, you know, clever. I've looked at Roger Moore films and I've winced at how sort of some of the humor and the jokes, but I still have a memory of those jokes when they were first told and the whole theater erupting with laughter.
Yes.
Because they were for that time.
Well, you know, that's an interesting thing too, that when you see a James Bond movie in a room full, a theater full of 800 people or whatever, it's a very different than watching them on your at home at night on your TV.
That's true of all film.
Yeah, but you've written so much for television, which is different. That's not a shared experience in the same way that a movie is. Do you approach a television show differently than a film?
I've had experience of writing movies, which have been, to be honest with you, quite tough, because when the stakes are so high and the budget is so enormous and every word on the page therefore costs so much, people are likely to question that word all the more.
Yeah.
And it also can take years and years for a film to reach the screen, whereas TV is fairly immediate. I've always preferred, of the two genres, writing for TV, partly because it means I can work with Jill, but also because they're closer to me. They're more of a home industry, if you like. You don't have, you know, a huge film company and a Hollywood boss or, you know, money men controlling you. It feels more close to me. I like both. I mean, there's nothing I write that I don't enjoy. I mean, that's one of the great pleasures of my life, which is that I can now choose what I write. And I turned down a film only a few months ago. It was a big film, and it was offered to me. And the younger Anthony would have done anything to be in it, but my antennae were twitching, and so I said no thanks. Film can be punishing. Theatre can be brutal because the critics get you on the night. You know, a critic who criticizes a book is criticizing something he wrote a year ago. A theatre critic, it's happening now, tonight, in front of you.
Yeah.
So that can be quite punishing too. But at the end of the day, it is the writing itself that I love. And I love all my writing, whatever I'm doing, pretty much equally.
Well, theater critics are the only critics left that actually have the power of the critic, because they can make or break whether people would go to see a play. Whereas nowadays, because of the internet, you know, everybody's a critic. And I wonder, do you ever look and read what your fans say about your books on Amazon?
No, I don't. I don't read my own. I don't read any reviews except for the ones my publishers send me, because they only send me the nicest ones. But it is interesting. Even theatre critics have lost some of their power, because there have been productions. I went to see a play the other night called O Mary, which I'm sure you've heard of. It's a big hit on Broadway, and it's now in London. I fell about laughing. I have to say I enjoyed it. Then I read some of the reviews that were in the English papers, you know, 2 stars. And I thought, well, you guys got it wrong, because that show's been on for ages. Everybody's loved it. And it's just won an Olivier Award, you know, and plays now can survive. The days of the famous Frank Rich, what was his name, the Butcher of Broadway, they're over to a large extent. You know, when that first newspaper arrived at the party after the play, if he'd given it a bad review, the party stopped. The orchestra left. The bottles were put back in the cupboard. But that's gone a bit.
Well, I think Hawthorne would agree that there's a difference between cinema and movies. That is, you go to some films and they're enjoyable and wonderful, but they're not cinema the way, you know, the classic films are. And I wonder, and I'm sure people have this attitude about literature as well. That is, you know, people, you know, I think The Great Gatsby is a crime novel, but people adore it more than a Raymond Chandler or, you know, Mickey Spillane, because it's F. Scott Fitzgerald. Do you find this with your books? Is there a difference? Do you feel there's a difference between popular literature and literature?
Well, I think, of course, there's a difference. Yes. I mean, I've talked about Dickens, and I could talk about Thackeray. I could talk about, you know, so many writers as Zola and many other, the great, great writers. Or I could go modern and talk about Kazuo Ishiguro or Sarah Walters, a writer I absolutely adore, who are, I think, writing great literature. Little Stranger, the greatest ghost story ever written. Take it from me.
Okay.
It's a wonderful book. And my books are on a different level. But that's not to say that one is better or more valuable than the other. I mean, or maybe it is to say that, but I'm not as good as those people. I do what I do, and I think I do it very well, or I try to do it very well. But it's been a long, long time since I've punished myself for not being a writer of great classics. You know, people ask me, will your work be remembered after you're dead? And I answer, well, A, I don't really care because I'm dead, and so I won't know. But B, probably not. And it doesn't matter, because other writers will come, and there'll be other crime writers and better crime writers. And so it goes on. You know, I'm having my moment and I'm enjoying it. But what more, you know, what more do I need than that?
I would say that your work will live on, and I find it incredibly enjoyable. And your new book, in the Hawthorne series, is called A Deadly Episode. Anthony Horowitz, thank you so much for spending so much time with me today.
I have really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf. And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon. I don't know.